is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, we're having a different kind of conversation. This is with two people, and they're not the writers, but the translators of a book. So I'm talking to Ellen Cassidy and Yirmiyahu Aaron Taub. They've translated this amazingly wonderful book called Oedipus in Brooklyn and Other Stories, written by Bluma Lempel. She was a Yiddish writer who lived in America. This book is published by Dryad Press and Mandel Vilar Press. And it's a remarkable collection. And even though we don't have the living author to talk to, I think talking to the two people who brought this from Yiddish into English should be really interesting. How are you both?
Good. Thank you.
Well,
great.
Thank you for joining me. And because we're not physically in the same room, with a three-way conversation, it's harder to share without interruption. So, if we do crosstalk a little bit, I hope our audience will forgive us. But I don't know who is the better person to answer this question, but how is it that you both discovered Bluma Lempel's work? And maybe you could talk a little bit about her life story, which is, I think, quite amazing and wonderful.
I'll start. Some years ago, I decided that I would study Yiddish as a memorial to my mother. My mother had not actually spoken Yiddish, in fact, but she sprinkled Yiddish words into her speech, sort of like a spice. And I started studying and quickly found that Yiddish had become a wonderful home for me within Jewish culture. And early on in my studies, I went to my teacher and I told him that I wanted to try my hand at translation. And he went straight to his bookshelf and pulled out a little gray volume by Bluma Lempel. And Aaron and I met in a Yiddish reading group. And Yirmiyahu, maybe you'd like to talk about where you came from, how you came to this project.
So I grew up in an ultra-Orthodox yeshiva family, surrounded by a number of languages, including Yiddish, Hebrew, Aramaic. And I formally studied Yiddish as an adult. I've been involved in Yiddish culture since the early 1990s as a reader, writer, translator, advocate for Yiddish culture, so to speak. When Ellen and I encountered Bluma Lempel's stories, we're both in a reading group in D.C., we were immediately captivated and indeed transported to her unique world.
She is amazingly modernist, coming from and original, coming from a background that has absolutely, it feels as if there's no literary background for her.
That's right. She was born in a small Jewish town, what we call a shtetl, in Poland in 1907, in a place that's now in Ukraine. And she moved to Paris in 1929, and this was the beginning of her becoming a really sophisticated artist. But she didn't write. She immigrated to New York just before World War II with her family. She was very fortunate in that respect, and that's when she began writing and publishing. And she ended up being published in Yiddish publications all over the world, and writing in Yiddish into the 1990s. She was part of a very shrinking worldwide network of writers who did continue to write in Yiddish and who supported each other. She died in 1999. And over the years, she received many literary prizes in Yiddish and was in correspondence with writers all over the world who were writing in Yiddish. And yet, you're right, she wasn't original, and she didn't feel part of any literary school or any trend in any language. An interviewer once asked her, who were her influences, which writers had been most important to her, and she couldn't think of any. She said, I feel I don't borrow from anyone. And she always wanted an English language readership, and she didn't have one. And now, finally, she's getting one with this first translation of her stories into English.
Well, one of the things that I did a little research on her, and part of her story seemed, it was such a struggle in some ways that, you know, when she was young, her father, who was a butcher, as was common then in Eastern Europe, educated her brother, but not her. And she kind of had a more basic education because the thinking was that a woman did not need an education. And so when she went to Paris, I think she was there to visit her brother, and she kind of decided to stay for whatever reason.
She was on her way to Palestine to be a pioneer.
That's right. And what I did learn, I think this is correct, is that she did begin writing. She also spoke French, but she wrote in Yiddish when she was in France, but didn't feel it was worthy and destroyed it.
Correct. And also her brother kind of discouraged her, feeling that she just didn't have the education enough to be a writer. By the way, she did mention the influence of Freud, Bergson, and Spinoza. Just briefly, sort of in passing, she just kind of threw those names out. And one can certainly see, that strong psychological influence in her writing. I don't know if she was in psychoanalysis or studied it.
Or maybe she just wrote from that place of inner being, because her stories do seem sort of kind of fitting in the Jewish storytelling vein. You know, there's all kinds of magical realism in the storytelling. You know, you switch places and times without any real concern, you know, that you're in this psychological state almost, or a dream world, where things happen in whatever order she says they happen.
Well, there's this idea, and this was pointed out by Yonya Fine, who is a poet and a writer, who is an admirer of hers, that there is no time in your stories, that it's almost as if the protagonist experiences time, different moments in time simultaneously,
right?
Which is a sort of foundational concept in psychology. You know, the idea that the unconscious has no memory. What took place yesterday is as important to the body, the mind, as what happened today. You know,
right,
so there's that kind of simultaneity of time in her work that's really powerful and very fresh.
Yeah, it's noticeable. Even if you come to reading it without any expectations, you quickly enter this other realm, you know, where things can happen outside of, it's not like Alice in Wonderland, but it does have that element of, as you said, time does not work the same way it does in linear conscious environments.
And we connect those narrative strategies to the fact that her own life was so full of tumult and so jagged that first she was in a small town, then she was in Paris, then she was in New York. And that sort of this disrupted life is reflected in the lives of many of her characters, and also finds its place right onto the page, so that first you're in one place, then you're in another place, and the transitions are very rough and raw.
Well, and also completely dominating so much is the fact of the Holocaust and seems to me the biggest dislocation of all, because in her world, she's here, all of that world has disappeared, and those people have to be alive in her consciousness and memory, and she writes for them in a conscious way, I think.
That's right. She once was accepting a prize, and she said this: "I feel I must speak for those who could no longer speak, feel for those who could no longer feel, immerse myself in their unlived lives, their sorrows, their joys, their struggle, and their death." But I think that might lead you to think that the stories are very somber, very dark, and there are definitely, you sometimes feel yourself plunged into an abyss. But at the same time, surprisingly, sometimes she's writing about meeting a homeless woman on the floor in Penn Station, New York, or about an African-American woman remembering her young years in Georgia, or a woman on an airplane flying to get a divorce in Reno. So very contemporary modern themes and characters are being conveyed in this language that we think of as the language of the old world, Eastern Europe, and it makes for a very potent combination.
Well, and I think for you've sort of touched on another element. I think for many people, Yiddish is thought of as the language of the shtetl. It's the, you know, for lots of children of immigrants in America who grew up here with their parents using Yiddish as the secret language to keep, you know, to talk about the things that they didn't want their children to know. But we did, and then for people who are not Jewish, have no, you know, it's sort of categorized as a dialect almost. And it's, I don't think it's recognized that there's a strong literary tradition in Yiddish culture. And maybe that's something you could talk about a little bit.
Well, first of all, what is Yiddish? It's a Germanic language, as a base of English is also Germanic. It's hundreds of years old. It's written in the Hebrew alphabet, but if you hear it pronounced, it sounds like a kind of German. And it was the vernacular for Jews all over Eastern Europe. And in fact, when Jews began to spread out over the world, European Jews, it became a kind of Esperanto in a way, a lingua franca that could be used by a Jew meeting a Jew in Shanghai or Australia or South Africa or Israel or wherever. And Hitler, you know, the impact of the Holocaust did a great deal to diminish the ranks of people who spoke Yiddish. And in fact, so did the Soviet Union. Yiddish was suppressed there. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that Yiddish was also suppressed in the young state of Israel, starting in the late 1940s. Hebrew was chosen as the official language of Israel, and Yiddish was looked down upon. In the United States, of course, assimilation did the job, and fewer people spoke Yiddish. But I have to say, for me, Yiddish is a holy tongue. And working as a translator in that language feels like sacred work. It's a very wonderful language, full of nuances and full of very quick changes of tone. English has that capacity too, but Yiddish is very precious to me for its irony, its humor, and the culture that it represents, which is always on the side of the little guy, the loser, and that honors the everyday and has a certain reverence for everyday events and everyday happenings.
Are there?
And if you're looking,
oh, go ahead. Sorry.
If you're looking for a kind of romanticized view of the shtetl, you will not find that in Blume Lempel's fiction. There is danger here. There is violence here. There are stories about rape. There's stories about the tension. The violence of revolutionary activity, the fears of Jews about non-Jewish violence, pogroms. There is that constant uncertainty about life. So it's not this kind of, I mean, yes, there are lovely evocations of the domestic scene, but it is not a romanticized view of the shtetl. The other thing that's particularly powerful about Lempel's evocation of the old world and actually the new world is her connection to nature. Virtually every story is filled with lyrical passages of the natural world. She felt this very intense connection to animal life, whether it's the squirrels that knew of Danny's arrival in the title story, whether it's Yasala foraging for food almost as a squirrel in the forest. In, I believe it's Yosemite, there's the forest itself is almost like a character. So she was very connected to the natural world, the gardens in the neighbor over the fence was very prominent. And then just insect life too. The fly, kind of maybe an odd reference to Kafka, perhaps, I don't know. But the fly is kind of a very prominent insect in several stories, kind of buzzes around. And she talks about, you know, different characters talk about the importance of the fly. So there's such a creativity here. There's such a kind of keen imagination. And there's such a kind of restlessness also, a refusal to kind of take anything for granted. Everything is kind of thrumming and vibrating. There's very little sort of placidity.
That must reflect her, kind of her intellect. It seems like that she was not a content to, you know, to just live a, you know, a kind of quotidian life.
Even though, you know, from the outside, it seemed like she was. She almost talked about how she was, you know, a housewife. Nobody knew about her writing in her neighborhood in Long Beach, New York. She was almost, it was almost something that she kept semi under wraps. Of course, you know, she sent out her stories and wanted to be published, wanted to be read, and herself advocated for her own work. But I think that kind of privacy and that kind of hiddenness gave her a kind of creative freedom that she might not otherwise have had. She talked about, yes, she wrote for those who perished, but she also wrote for herself. And she saw herself as kind of a book for them, you know, kind of someone who's occupied by the dead, whose body, a living soul, whose body is inhabited by the dead. And that kind of intensity, that kind of commitment to her work kind of propelled her throughout those long years.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, it's unavoidable that you have to recognize her, the particularities of her life as a woman in the, in a period and in a culture perhaps, or in at least in a family setting that didn't, that caused her to protect that part of herself.
I mean, even it sort of, it figures in several of the stories. For example, A Snowstorm in Summerland, the husband figure kind of dismisses the wife's, you know, he says, oh, are you writing your poetry
right.
again?
Right.
And if Ellen, correct me if I'm mistaken, but I believe even in The Neighbor Over the Fence, Betty, the Jewish title character, the Jewish main characters, she's just this person at a typewriter, presumably Betty Bluma. You know, but she doesn't even go into her own writing or herself as a writer there. She's just this housewife at her typewriter, which again is kind of, it's protective. It's also kind of playful. It's kind of ironic. And it's kind of, there's something joyous about it too. This kind of, you know, that kind of determination. To go on to create art in suburbia in Long Beach. You know, she didn't really participate in kind of Yiddish culture. I mean, there's a little bit. She went to some meetings and, you know, different writers and students sought her out. And she certainly had a rich epistolary life with other writers, but she really wasn't at the center of whatever was left of kind of intellectual Yiddish culture in the post-war, era.
Which writers did she write to and from? I'm curious about that. Were they other European immigrant writers who were writing in Yiddish?
So she wrote with, she corresponded with Chava Rosenfarb, who was a Yiddish writer living in Montreal from Poland. An immigrant from Poland who wrote these epic kind of social realist novels about Jewish life in Poland, in particular the Holocaust. They
one
had a long correspondence. I'm sorry, Ellen, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Her most important correspondence was Avram Sutzkever, who was the editor of a prestigious Yiddish journal being published in Tel Aviv after the war. All of these people were refugees from Hitler's Europe. Either they had been through the Holocaust or they had barely escaped before the Holocaust. And I think of it as almost like a cafe society, except that it was scattered all over the world and they didn't meet face to face, but they wrote letter after letter and supported each other very deeply. Now, in the case of the title story of this collection, Oedipus in Brooklyn, Sutskever, who was in general a very supportive and very important person for her, her editor, who published story after story after story, he refused to publish this story because he said it was too shocking. But when we read it, yes, we were shocked by the theme, which is indeed about a contemporary Jewish mother in the late 20th century who becomes involved in a relationship with her son. I don't think I've ever read anything like that besides the Oedipus Rex back in the Greek times. She handles the topic with such sensitivity and tact and subtlety that there's nothing, I didn't find it shocking. I didn't find it certainly not sensational or obscene. She really masterfully draws you into this story of this woman and her son as they move toward their doom. And it's extremely compelling story that takes place, you know, right in the United States and right under our noses, really.
She also corresponded with Malka Haifetz-Tosman, who was a poet, Yiddish poet living in Berkeley. She received letters from the great Yiddish writer Chaim Grada. She corresponded with Yonya Fine, who I mentioned earlier, who actually has only recently passed away. She had a lot of admirers kind of in the Yiddish world. But yeah, the circle of sort of regular correspondents, I would say, were probably those. She also had visitors. We know of Nissen Brusilov, who was a Yiddish writer who came to visit, and they had chats regularly.
So she, I mean, it sounded like she was recognized probably later in her life, you know, by some by those who had read her and kind of wanted to recognize her, her contributions and her work, it seems like.
Right. And I just came across a letter from her to another Yiddish writer where it's 1985 and already one collection of her stories has come out, been published in Yiddish. And she's trying to figure out whether to publish the second volume in Yiddish or whether she should just take all the most recent stories to a translator and try to get the book to come out in English. And that didn't happen. So we are the ones who are bringing these amazing stories to an English language readership, really for the first time as a collection. And we went through her two published collections and also looked at journals for uncollected stories. And we came up with these 24 pieces that are between the covers of Oedipus in Brooklyn. And so finally her dream is being recognized and realized. And it became our dream too. As we were translating her, we sort of immersed ourselves deep into her consciousness and her aesthetic. And it feels very, very special to have these stories finally available to people who don't know Yiddish, which is most readers.
Right. No, it's, I think that, and you, I mean, I, obviously, since I don't read Yiddish, I can't tell you what I, you know, how I can't judge the original, but I think your translations are really, really good. And I love these stories.
Yeah, so do we. And I think something that I only realized when I began translating was that really it's a love of English that really carries you through. I adore Yiddish, but I also adore English. And it's really that the English language readers who you have to be loyal to as you bring them these treasures from the past. One person, fellow translator, describes it as saying basically your stance is, I've just met a beautiful stranger I'd like to introduce you to. And that's what it's like to bring this wonderful literature to people who have never met it before. And we're the people who are saying, look at this.
Well, and the thing about being a translator is that you're actually an advocate for this writer's work. You're bringing this writer's work out there, so you don't really have to be modest, but you know, the way you would be about your own work necessarily. Like, I mean, we can just say, you know, I mean, her work is really powerful, and we really hope that people really get a lot out of these stories, as we think they will. We think they're really vivid and musical and lyrical and emotional.
I think they are. And as we talked about them earlier, I think they are striking in their kind of ability to manage through so many different frameworks, you know, kind of living mm-hmm. frameworks. I really like that. I did want you to read this at maybe. It's a short piece in comparison to some longer than others, and it's probably not a magical one in the same sense as some of the other ones, but it's just this piece called The Fate of the Yiddish Writer seemed so apropos for anyone who is a writer or who wants to be a writer, whether you're Yiddish or not. I thought it was wonderful. I don't know whether we have time for you to read the whole thing, but maybe you could read and then let's see what happens.
Okay, so I'll start. The Fate of the Yiddish Writer. I am a housewife, a wife, a mother, a grandmother, and a Yiddish writer. I write my stories in Yiddish. Yiddish is in my bones. When I hear my mother's oi in my head, I lift my eyes to the heavens and hear God answering me in Yiddish. The birds, real and imagined, speak Yiddish, and the wind at my window speaks Yiddish because I speak Yiddish. Think in Yiddish. My father and mother, my sisters and brothers, my murdered people seek revenge in Yiddish. No world language is comparable to Yiddish, with its unique size, its unmatched sense of humor. After the melody has died away and the tears have ebbed, there remains an echo that travels on the wind. Do not wipe out the language that accompanied your people to the mass grave. The echo says, do not take up the murderer's sword with your own hand. Do not allow the word that bloomed in bitter climes to wither. Remember Amalek. Remember Hitler. Do not extinguish the spark that smolders in the ashes. Those who deny the past can have no future. Remember. So here I sit, writing from right to left. My older brother watches over me, telling me what to write in Yiddish. I can't very well ask him not to speak in the language of exile. Blessed with the gifts of a prodigy, he knows what I'm thinking. Yiddish is not a language of exile, he answers my unspoken words. It is Mama Lushan, our mother tongue. I have tremendous respect for my brother. He believed in the goodness of man, the goodness of all. He met with a double disaster. Disappointed first in his faith, then in himself. Now he watches over me, directing my stories from beyond the grave with a sure touch. This is how it was. This is what happened. So must it be recorded. Each according to his ability must convey what he saw, what he lived through, what he thought, what he felt. You did not survive simply to eat blintzes with sour cream. You survived to bring back those who were annihilated. You must speak in their tongue, point with their fingers. I sit and I write, page after page, covering reams with my handwriting. In truth, I'm sorry to part with these pages full of the tears and laughter of my girlfriends and the boys they fell in love with, all in Yiddish. I'm sorry to let go of the men in their kaftans and the women they quarreled and made up with, always in Yiddish. I'm sorry to send off the cozy sounds and colors that imbued Jewish life with such beauty and charm back then. Reluctant to send them away across the ocean to a place where Yiddish is seen as a source of embarrassment. The very language that nurtured the Zionist dream and brought it to fruition is now untouchable in that land. But since I belong to this people that spits in its own face, I pack up my manuscript and send it off to Israel. I'm not expecting to become rich or famous. My reward is the writing itself, the putting down on paper of that which will not leave me in peace. Above all, I don't want to forsake my brother and end up isolated and alone in my own home. Meanwhile, I sit and wait for an answer. I wait as if my writing were entirely dependent on the publisher's yes or no. While I'm waiting, the muse abandons me. After assembling some 300 pages, I want to know what the experts have to say. But it turns out the experts don't actually read the manuscript. All they do is count the pages and send the author a bill for the publishing. So many sheets amount to a 5 followed by 3 fat zeros. To proofread the galleys and illustrate the title page raises the price by 1, followed by another 3 zeros. They politely ask for half the total as soon as possible to enable them to continue their work.
I'll take up the story. Faced with collecting such a fantastic sum of money, the masochist in me takes charge, reminding me that I have in my possession a gold chain and a sparkling diamond ring, and pointing out that I could get along perfectly well without such vanities. It tells me where to sell the jewelry. Just listen to the radio, it says. The announcer will provide the address. I put down my writing tools and do as I'm told. As soon as I've sent the check, I return to my desk. But instead of picking up my pen, I take my head in my hands and rock like a mourner after a funeral. My resentment grows. In tears, I go to the telephone and call a close friend, a well-known poet. I pour out my bitter heart. "What are you talking about?" he says in response to my agitated words. "Where have you been? Don't you understand how our literary racket works? Wait until the book is out in print. Then you'll really see what it means to be a writer among Jews. I hate to say it, but unless you want your books to gather dust in the cellar, you're going to have to roll up your sleeves and distribute them yourself." "But where?" I asked, dumbfounded. "How?" "Well, you may ask," he says. "You'll learn to beg addresses from friends and acquaintances. Some will send you a few dollars and others won't. But first, my dear, you'll do what old Noah did. You'll send your book out into the world like the dove from the ark, and you'll wait for the critics to respond. Yes, my friend, it's not easy, but there's no way around it. For Yiddish writers like us, such is fate."
I think that is perfect. It's just, it is wonderful.
And not just for Yiddish writers.
No, exactly. That's why I think it's so wonderful. Well, I really want to thank you both, Ellen Cassidy and Yirmiyahu Aaron Taub, for talking to me about Oedipus in Brooklyn and Other Stories by Bluma Lempel. It's a terrific book. I commend you for this effort. I think it's a really major act of love and literature to do this. So thank you.
Thank you so much,
Dave. Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk.